Welcome to the Move With Your Life podcast. Real stories, real heart, real people moving with their lives. Brought to you by Boundless Wellness Coaching. Hey everybody, and welcome to Move With Your Life. I just wanted to hop on here quickly to give you a heads up about the next few segments where we will be covering the topic of self-compassion. I've recently begun my master's in counseling program, and it's why I haven't been on here quite as much as I was in the past. If you're in school, you know how busy it is. My hat is off to you. But I also wanted to come back and share some of the things that I'm learning about within this program, particularly around the topic of self-compassion. I feel it's such an important one for our time. And so I think you're really going to enjoy these conversations. I know I will. So I wanted to talk about the three components that I'm learning about as they relate to self-compassion. So three components of self-compassion are self-kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. So all three of these are integrated. You cannot sustainably interact with common humanity or with self-kindness without being mindful about your situation, for example. So we'll talk about the integration, but we'll also touch on each one of them as their own topic and how we can practically approach them. So self-compassion is something that we're hearing a lot about in our society. It's all over social media, a lot, self-care, all these topics that are buzzwords. But I think that it's about more than just taking care of yourself. I think it's about more than just loving yourself. I think it's about taking a look at your experiences and how you relate to those experiences throughout your story, and then how you integrate them into the common goal of healing humanity. So how can we support one another and begin to see each other as all beings with struggles, with experiences, and really integrating our own learning with the learning of others? I think this will be a really cool way of approaching it, and I hope you enjoy the topics that we go into. For today, we're going to focus mainly on the broader concept of self-compassion and maybe a story around how someone has come into understanding what self-compassion looks like for them and how they've integrated their experiences in their own journey now. So Leslie Frick is someone who I worked with as a Boundless client. She is an amazing human. She's a social worker. She's been through all kinds of different iterations of social work, but recently she has begun working in the mental health field, supporting specifically alternative high school students, and she really enjoys that work. She says she's heard people talking about becoming the adult you needed when you were younger, and she thinks that's how her position resonates so strongly with her now. She feels that she's become the adult that she needed when she was younger. So what she does for fun, she does anything creative, she loves anything related to art, and especially she's noticed an incredible spark of creativity since starting her sobriety journey. She'll talk more about that with us. She also loves doing anything outside with forests, waterfalls, mountains, and she's pretty sure she was a mermaid in another life. That's pretty cool. Rock hounding is also one of her favorite things, which is basically just finding interesting rocks and collecting them, breaking them open, or polishing them. And one word to describe her is nascent. It basically means beginning to exist. And lately, she's felt that she's just really getting to know herself for the first time in her life. Her favorite snack is fruit of any kind, or something crunchy and salty. So like all dressed chips, they're a go-to lately. Sounds delicious. And her favorite way to move her body, when a song comes on that feeds her soul, she just has to dance. I don't blame you, Leslie. I love dancing too. I always am doing it in the car. Probably look ridiculous. I also asked Leslie to tell me in advance which pillar or component of self-compassion stands out to her the most and why. And she identifies that self-kindness stands out the most because it's something that she's found to be the most challenging and something that she didn't even recognize as being a challenge for her for most of her life until more recently. She really feels that we're socially constructed to believe that our intrinsic worth is based on our productivity and our status in society, as well as how well we meet the expectations of others. And that impacts us in the sense that we begin having a really hard time reflecting truly on ourselves. We have a hard time being kind to ourselves the way that we would to others, because serving others fills the need to be admired and wanted and connected. We've never been so connected to others with technology, but we've also never been so disconnected as we are now. And so she really feels self-kindness is the one that stands out the most to her. So we're going to chat more about that and all things related to self-compassion. I hope you really enjoy this conversation, and let's get into it. Leslie, welcome to Move With Your Life. Thanks for coming and being on the show with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So Leslie, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your career, maybe what it's like to be a mom, and we'll start there.
Yeah, for sure. So I chose the field of social work. I think subconsciously it was always something I've been drawn to because I've always really enjoyed working with people. And I noticed that I kind of had a tendency of being drawn to supporting people who have had a tough time or maybe struggle with a history of grief or loss or trauma. I even remember when I was a teenager being a camp counselor for a camp that specifically supported children in like the foster care system and things like that. So I always really had a passion for working with people and especially kids. So when I was in university and I started to learn more about social systems, and it really kind of opened my eyes, especially when it came to things like privilege and just the way that our society is set up to kind of, in a way that kind of creates and maintains and perpetuates different forms of oppression, and typically in systemic fashion, unfortunately. So it's a little bit harder to identify, but I realized that I wanted to continue to help and give back and use my privilege to do good. So my background is in child protection. I was on the high-risk Indigenous youth team for child protection services in Calgary. And that was a very baptism by fire job. That was probably one of the most intense jobs that I've ever had. And the burnout after a few years was absolutely unreal. And I think it was just because the caseload started to get so high that we were working with so many high-risk youth that it ended up just being crisis management. So we weren't actually able to do any of the social work that we wanted to. It was just kind of like putting Band-Aids on everything. And I ended up losing a couple kids that I worked with, and just realizing that the system was so incredibly broken down that nobody has the answers to resolve the problems. And after I became a mom, I realized that at the end of the day, I didn't have enough left over for me in that job, that there was no way I was going to be able to show up for my kid the way that they would need if I couldn't even show up for myself the way that I needed. So now I actually work as a mental health support kind of person. The technical term is a family school liaison worker, but I work at a outreach high school. So I still work with a very awesome and unique population of kiddos who, you know, still have that. A lot of them have that background of grief and loss and trauma, and they've been through some hard things. But I'm really glad. Like that's my jam. That's my passion, is working with those kids. So, and it's funny because like I've heard a lot of people saying lately about that you become the adult that you needed when you were younger. And I do remember when I was in school for social work, there was a part of me that was like, being a high school counselor, like something similar to that would be really wonderful, because that was someone that I could have really used when I was in school.
Mm. What was it about that particular role you think would have been useful for you?
I think just to have somebody kind of reassuring me that there wasn't anything wrong with me, that I was just going through a tough time, and basically just someone to give me that that validation and support that I think I really needed, that all kids need really when they're growing up, and just didn't really have that. I mean, I only ever got sent to the office if it was for something negative.
Yeah, right. Typically, yeah. Go to the office.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, like I tell people, like when I think about my time in elementary school, like I honestly don't know who I was bullied worse by, like other like classmates or teachers. Like it's, but it's been really amazing to see how far teachers have come now and like school staff have come now. And I think that's one of the reasons that I love the outreach schools so much, is because seeing staff and teachers with not even necessarily like a professional mental health background, but just having a lot more empathy and compassion and like really acknowledging the unique backgrounds of our students and like trying to meet them where they're at and getting them where they want to go, as opposed to, you know, a typical high school model that's very like, these are our standards and you need to rise up to meet them. And it's like, well, yeah. No, like if your mental health isn't in a good place, like you're going to really struggle getting to where you want to go. So like, what can we do to help? And I always tell my kids that I would have definitely been a student at an outreach school if that was an option when I was younger, for sure.
Interesting. And like, I see a little bit of a thread here. Like, walk me back a bit through your transition into going to social work. You have this passion where you want to help youth from a young age. You feel like this is something that people could use, particularly you could have used it when you were that age. But it sounds like you were already maybe starting out in a high burnout field from a little bit of a burnout yourself then. Does that feel true?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. And I think part of the acknowledgement and the realization too is especially becoming a mom and just not realizing the burnout, like from the job, but then, you know, 2020, the pandemic happened, and then my partner was in RCMP training, and just because of the way COVID and not isolation, quarantine and all those regulations worked, he actually ended up getting sent to training like a week before Bruce was born, so he wasn't there for the birth of his child. And then we moved when Bruce was 3 months old to, you know, a small northern Alberta town where we left our friends and family behind. So it was just like, I don't know, there's like burnout, and then there's whatever that is called, where it's just like, it just so many extreme changes all at once that you don't even know which way is up.
It says sound a lot. You changed the word isolation, but it sounds a lot like isolation, a lot like isolation fatigue, really. And I don't know if that's a technical term either, but I feel like when we are coming from a place of having to leave something behind that was our support network to something new, there is a huge amount of self-doubt and loneliness and stress that comes upon us, right? So I can totally hear that as being something that maybe was part of your story, is the isolation combined with the burnout.
Definitely. Wow. But I was really grateful that a couple weeks before COVID started shutting everything down, that was actually when I got my yoga teacher certification. So it I was really grateful to be able to at least go into the pandemic with a whole new toolbox of things that I could kind of fall back on when I needed to. And those tools were used a lot and have been used ever since.
Totally. And I want to get into that before we go there. So coming out of something where you felt maybe emotionally burnt out as a youth, going into a high burnout field, what lessons did you learn about perhaps what's lacking in the system in terms of creating environments for self-compassion? And maybe, what's something you learned, and maybe what's something you feel people need to understand when they're working in those high burnout professions?
Just that you really need to take care of yourself. And like, I know therapists talk about, you know, you can't pour from an empty cup. And like you said, starting like going into that field when your cup is like already near empty, you have to make sure that you are making time to prioritize yourself and having those boundaries for yourself too when it comes to empathy, because empathy can be a very, very powerful and very wonderful tool. But if it crosses that line where your empathy for a client or somebody that you're working with, and you're empathizing so strongly with their story, and it can start to become toxic when it starts to negatively impact your own well-being while you're trying to support them. So being able to kind of recognize that and take a step back from that is really important. And also not being afraid to make a shift or make a change if it's needed. And I think that was one of the biggest things that I was afraid of when I decided to leave my government job, because I mean, that's a government position with a salary and pension and benefits, like all the things that you are supposed to quote unquote want and like work really hard for when you're a responsible adult. And so I think it was that messaging that was just so drilled into my brain that made it really hard to leave, and probably caused me to stick around longer than I should have. And it took me becoming a mom to recognize that I wasn't able to properly take care of myself the way I needed to in that job. So I think having the courage to take a step back from something, even when society is telling you, but this is the ideal, like this is what you're supposed to want, this is supposed to be the end goal. Not being afraid to take that step back and being like, okay, well, maybe this is the end goal for some people, but this isn't a fit for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that in itself, I feel, is an act of self-compassion, that you chose yourself beyond what people expected of you, beyond what the career life, adult life, quote unquote, expects of us, right? You chose something that took you outside of that into your dreams and your goals and to where you are now. Before we dive into that, I guess I'm curious about how you would define self-compassion and how that plays into the decisions that you made to perhaps move into the places that you are now.
Self-compassion is such a big, wonderful, daunting thing. I think self-compassion is acknowledging that you have intrinsic worth and value, and that you've always been enough. So it's being able to hold space for yourself and all that you are with empathy and understanding, even in the moments when you've made the wrong choice or if you've made a mistake. You can have compassion for yourself and still hold yourself accountable for harms you've caused or mistakes that you've made. But I think the difference is having self-compassion allows you to learn from those choices and move forward in a good way with the best intention, as opposed to not having self-compassion and then you just kind of live in that downward spiral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And I think you're right. Living the downward spiral is the opposite of choosing that compassion for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'm curious about, we've talked about work a little bit, but is there a time in your life that you've had to learn that sort of self-compassion or really sort of shake yourself out of it, into it? And then what did that look like for you?
I feel like my whole life has almost been like trying to learn how to be self-compassionate and being kind to myself, mostly just because I feel like if you're never taught that as a kid, or you're never taught that growing up, that it's a really hard thing to figure out for yourself. Because I think that you're constantly kind of projecting a reflection of what other people find valuable in you.
Definitely.
Yeah. So almost kind of similar to like masking, like just kind of reflecting or presenting in a way that you think other people want you to. I don't know. I tend to think like more recently, I think one of my more challenging times that I really acknowledge that I need to be self-compassionate and I'm practicing really hard is I do tend to ruminate on the past a lot sometimes, especially in unhealthy and unhelpful ways, but especially when it comes to my past struggles with alcohol and using alcohol like all throughout my 20s and as a coping strategy, and just the mistakes I made, the people I hurt, the money I wasted, but like most of all the time that I wasted. And have a tendency of beating myself up for that, and I can get caught in that spiral when I think about it too much. But I did actually hear a quote, I think it was like 6 months ago, it came across my feed at like the perfect moment, and it really resonated with me, and it's something that I keep reminding myself if I start to get caught in that spiral. And it's okay to forgive and let go of the versions of yourself that you created just to survive. Wow. And it hit me like a ton of bricks, because those words almost helped me kind of give myself permission to look back on my past with empathy and compassion rather than judgment. And because even though I acknowledge that, you know, I made some choices that weren't healthy or productive, I think they were choices that I made in those moments because they kept my head above the water. Mm-hmm. In some way, shape, or form, they gave me what I needed to exist in those moments. Mm-hmm. They met a need, served a purpose, and kept me here, even if it was sometimes messy or ugly. And we do the best with what we have. And now looking back, I'm kind of able to be like, man, like that girl was in so much pain and she was so lost, but like, she's going to be okay.
Wow. And does that still feel for you in that rumination? Does it feel like you have to actively positive self-talk out of it? Or does it feel like more of a visceral body sensation of like, I need to kind of move into a practice to forgive myself and express self-compassion? Is it more like a practical verbal thing, or is it more of an experiential thing?
I would say probably a combination of both. I think it's definitely getting a little bit easier. Just like from a logical sense of being like, yeah, but you know, like people change and people grow and people move forward. And I have done a lot of hard work, especially in the last couple of years, to travel on my healing journey. And I've made the choice like not to touch alcohol again. And I mean, come January 1st, it'll be 2 years of sobriety. And I mean, ask me 5 years ago and I never would have even thought that would have been in my future. And
congratulations. I want to pause to say congratulations to you as well. What a big milestone to get to. Yeah.
Thank you. I've worked really hard, and it feels really good. Cause it is getting easier though to look back with empathy and compassion. And I do notice that the longer I'm on this healing journey, the easier self-compassion is becoming.
Yeah. Wow. And what does easier look like? Like, what does it mean to have it become easier for you? Like, walk us through what that would have looked like maybe even a year ago versus now.
I think even a year ago, I would probably still have a tendency of putting other people first or sacrificing my own comfort and well-being because I don't want to make somebody else uncomfortable or upset somebody else. You know, even if maybe they're not exactly coming from a good place. Whereas now I don't shy away from what I think I need, like, and as long as it's still like coming from a place of good intention, and as long as I'm still coming from a place of kindness, but I'm also not willing to jeopardize my own well-being or the well-being of my family for other people's comfort. Like it's, you know, I spent so many years doing that because I thought that that's what was going to make me happy. And yeah. Obviously that didn't work out very well because I was using alcohol to make myself feel better for so many years.
Right.
Why
wouldn't you? Right. It's that numbing. Yeah. It's that numbing behavior that we all do, I think, when we're feeling that our well-being is threatened, but we don't acknowledge it.
Yeah. It's, somebody was, something else I saw online that I thought was really funny. And it was talking about like, oh, you know, all these women in their 30s thinking that they're entering their villain era, but really they're just recovering people pleasers. And I was like, ouch, oh. Hey, what? Oh my gosh.
Yep. Right. That hits.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
hits.
Absolutely. It does.
Yeah.
That landed pretty rough. And I was like, holy shit. That's exactly, I thought I was being a badass all of a sudden, but it's like, no, you're just enforcing very healthy boundaries with people and you've never done that before. So it feels like you're being a badass, but you're actually starting to put yourself first. So
Leslie was a client of mine with Boundless, and she's chatted with me a little bit about her learnings around her own diagnosis of ADHD as well. Yes. And the connection between ADHD, past substance use. I would even maybe argue, at least from what I know of it for myself, the connection to people pleasing. When did you first start realizing these connections for yourself, and how did those realizations change your view of your own experience and story?
Ooh, well, so it wasn't until after I became a mom. So after Bruce was born, and, you know, people had kind of joked around about mom brain and whatnot. So it was almost like I was kind of waiting for that mom brain to go away. Cause I mean, obviously through my pregnancy, I was able to abstain from alcohol completely. So I wasn't using my regular coping mechanism and actually felt really good. And then after Bruce was born, I started to realize like, okay, like my brain fog is getting really bad and I'm forgetting things, like my emotional regulation was completely out the window. And so it was just like I was constantly waiting for things to get better. And then it was actually, it's really funny, and I might get some hate for this, but it wasn't until my friend convinced me to download that freaking time sucker TikTok app. I mean, I was on it for like, you know, fun crafts and things like that, and camping hacks and organizational hacks, you know, like the millennial side of TikTok, I would say. Right. But then it was really funny because I started to notice that the algorithm started bringing all these ADHD videos across my feed. And I remember being like, oh, like, that's funny. Like, I do that and I do that and I do all those things, but like, I don't have ADHD. Like, that's really silly. And so I was talking to my friends, fiance at the time, who's also a therapist and also has ADHD, and I was telling her how funny that was, and she was just kind of like, oh, so like, how do you know you don't have ADHD? And I was like, well, because I don't. And she's like, oh, okay. And so she gave me a couple assessments from her like therapist portal or whatever, and supposed to be like just for fun, and I completed them and sent them to her, and then she ended up calling me and was like, you know, like, you might want to make an appointment with your doctor. And was like, oh my gosh. Then while all that was kind of happening, as we all know, whoever's gone through the process, we know how long of a process it can be. And I was still drinking at that time. And when I first kind of started researching all of this, but then I think it was New Year's Day 2 years ago. And I was really disappointed because we were supposed to have family come and visit, or I think we were supposed to go visit family. And this speaks to the isolation piece. Mm-hmm. And I was just so desperate to see family, and ended up not being able to do the trip because we got sick. Mm-hmm. And I was so disappointed. And so did what I always did, self-medicated, got really drunk on New Year's Eve, knew that I was drinking way too much, didn't care. And I woke up with a super nasty hangover. And of course, like, my son being, you know, just over a year old, wanting to spend time with mom, and I didn't want anything to do with him because I was so hungover. And oh my God, I still tear up when I think about it, but like the hangover combined with the extreme mom guilt in that situation was the first time that I truly knew that I was done, and that I would never choose alcohol over spending time with my child ever again. And I haven't since. And when I started my sobriety journey, I'd been waitlisted for the ADHD assessment, and I don't think it happened till about March or so. And so I started kind of doing my own research, and that's when I came across a bunch of articles that talked about undiagnosed ADHD and the connection with substance use disorder and mm-hmm. how common it is to use drugs and alcohol to self-medicate without even mm-hmm. realizing that you're self-medicating because you don't even know you have this diagnosis. And then it was like, my mind was just blown. Like all mm-hmm. these puzzle pieces fell into place. And I'm not saying that that's the only reason that I consumed alcohol. I'm sure there's a lot of wonderful history and trauma that goes into that as well. But like I can remember being in university and would have a paper due and couldn't even focus on it. But if I had like 4 or 5 glasses of wine, I could sit down and, you know, pump out a paper in like 7 hours, no problem. Or I was a social butterfly when I was drinking. Like people thought that I was like the most social person ever. And now that I'm sober, I wouldn't say that I'm not social, but like, I definitely have like a limit of like, okay, I'm spent now and I'm going to go home.
Like you hit your wall.
Yeah, totally. Whereas before, like I could drink and party and socialize till like 3, 4 in the morning and then wake up and do it all over again. Yeah. So it was really crazy just to think about the amounts of time that alcohol was actually self-medicating, a diagnosis I didn't even know that I had. And I thought, it was tough because I was like, man, like being sober is supposed to like make things easier, but like why is my brain still so loud and why are things like things almost feel a little bit harder after you know, the honeymoon phase of sobriety where you kind of hit your plateau of like, this is as good as you're going to physically and mentally feel from being sober, which is great. But then it was like, okay, now what? Why am I still feeling this cloud or whatever? And then when I got my ADHD diagnosis, it all kind of clicked into place. And like not even just from like, you know, the last decade, but like even like elementary school and stuff, mm-hmm. like all these things making so much more sense and being like, this is why I was pulled into the hallway so often, or, you know, this is why I was bullied and picked on, because, you know, like my brain worked a little bit differently. So I stuck out in all these, you know, ways that people didn't want to manage or deal with. It was intense. I definitely went through a grief stage of my diagnosis where I cried and hurt for a long time because I kept thinking about me growing up and being younger and what could have been different had I known then. And now, especially realizing like there's never anything wrong with me. My brain was just worked a little differently. And you live as a neurodivergent mind in a world designed for neurotypical people, like that in itself is exhausting.
Right.
So, but having that diagnosis, I think, has also helped me have a lot more self-compassion. Because for the first time in my life, I think I was able to kind of like look to my inner child and say like, hey, like it's okay. This isn't your fault and you never did anything wrong.
Wow. Whew. And has it always been that easy to look at your inner child? There's so much research out these days about how girls experience ADHD as anxiety and depression, not as that hyper like squirrely outward look to ADHD that maybe we might think of when we think of boys who have ADHD, although that's also different depending. And then there's a spectrum of gender as well. So, you know, who knows how everyone experiences it. It's all different. But my expression was that anxiety feeling. So when I look back at her, sometimes I'm just like, oh, she was just like, she was too anxious or she was too flighty or she was too. So I guess what I'm asking is like, how did you transition from that judgment phase of like looking back at your story with some judgment or pain to then the self-love, self-compassion? Like, I see you. And if this had been different, maybe I could have hugged you differently or cared for you differently.
It's still tough because I feel like I still kind of get caught up in the, you know, I'm trying to be careful and gentle with myself and saying like, you know, just because you have this diagnosis, you know, doesn't mean that like if you didn't have this diagnosis, like why couldn't you look back with the same compassion as well. So that's kind of something that I've been thinking, right? And that's something I've been thinking really about a lot lately too. But I think it is it definitely made things easier to have self-compassion, getting that diagnosis and just being able to be like, okay, it makes sense. It makes sense why things were so hard. It makes sense why I just couldn't fit the way that people mm-hmm. needed me to. And then I spent so long trying so hard to fit. And then that was the most miserable I've ever been in my life. And almost feeling like because of my sobriety journey and having that diagnosis and, I'm taking medication because I do feel that it does make a huge difference and that it does help. And it's not, medication is not for everybody. So you have to find what works for you. But I do feel like I'm almost getting to know myself for the first time because I'm no longer reflecting what people wanted me to be in elementary and high school. And I'm no longer self-medicating with alcohol the way I was all throughout my 20s and being that version of myself anymore. And so now it's really dropping the mask and allowing myself to be who I am, but also having no idea who that person is.
Interesting. That's so beautiful. And I often think if we could all get to this place where we could drop the mask, would we even have things like alcohol at parties? Do you know, would we even have, like, it's a curiosity question for me. Would we even have things like these self-medication opportunities, right?
Yeah.
Because we would just be comfortable to just be where we are without needing to change our states. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm very curious about that. And I mean, that's a high level curiosity. I feel like you could argue about that for days, like the benefits, pros and cons of the things that we offer socially to people. But I'm very curious about what it would look like if we could just put down the mask for all of us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that can even, you know, snowball into the bigger question of like, who gets to decide what normal is?
Yes.
Like whose definition is that? And like, when I talk about, you know, being a neurodivergent brain in a world built for neurotypical people, like it's like, how did that happen?
Well, exactly. And the more people you talk to, like yourself, myself, almost all of my friend group, mm-hmm. whenever you talk to somebody, they have something.
Yeah.
Right. Like someone might have depression. Someone might have anxiety. Someone might have ADHD. Someone might be on the spectrum, like autism spectrum. There's mm-hmm. there's all kinds of things. And it's rare that I meet someone who's like, oh, no, I'm good. So I'm like, what even is neurotypical? Like, no one is. Like, what is this? You know? Interesting. Yeah.
I was talking to my partner about that because he's been such an amazing person like through my healing journey. And I feel like this poor guy is probably getting to know me for the first time in 15 years as well. So that's got to be hard on him. But we were talking about that and I was like, I think we were talking about the ACEs test. And we're talking about trauma and it was like, so like what traumas happened in your life? And he's like, oh, like nothing, like I'm good. And I'm like, no, but like actually, and like legitimately, I don't think he's had any significant trauma in his life. And that's mind blowing to me.
Yeah. And beautiful. Like, and I'm grateful that he hasn't. Yeah.
Oh no, for sure. I don't think I've met a lot of people that can say that.
So. I don't think I have either. And so it's an interesting conversation is like, then, yeah, how do we build a new world where the normal is the divergent?
Yeah.
You know, that's a bigger conversation, but anyways. So
speaking of squirrel brains getting sidetracked.
Squirrel brains. Yeah, exactly. That's what we do. So curious then about your story and in, you know, you've been through these waves of change and you've been through different careers. You've had this diagnosis probably for a long time, but not been officially diagnosed. What has been the most challenging part of choosing to be self-compassionate through all of that?
I think like we kind of touched on like dropping the mask and allowing myself to exist unfiltered without embarrassment or worry. Yeah. Like since my journey, my sobriety journey and my diagnosis journey kind of like aligned timing wise. I think it's, I've been doing a lot of reflection and holy shit, healing is fucking hard. I apologize if I'm not supposed to swear.
That's okay. I swear in here too. You're good.
But like healing is like that shit is hard. I had no idea how hard it was going to be sitting with all of those feelings. Oh, my headphones might be dying. Sorry. But I had no idea how hard it was, like, just to sit with those feelings and letting them be whatever they needed to be. So, I think like even just looking at old wounds and like allowing them to reopen so that I can clean them out properly so that they'll heal in a way that leaves the smallest scar. And I think that's part of what therapy does too. And I mm-hmm. think when people talk about like therapy is making things worse, and it's like, well, yeah, of course, like you are literally ripping open those old wounds so that they can be cared for properly and Absolutely. You can learn how to heal them without those moments when you think about them moving forward, taking over your life the same way that they did before. So I think that's been really challenging, is just allowing those things to happen and allowing myself to be vulnerable and giving myself permission to take up space to like talk about, you know, my past and my trauma or my lack of emotional attachment or connection or validation growing up, and healing and hearing a voice in the back of my head being like, well, like, while you're healing, like, what if you start scaring people away? Being your authentic self. So, but I know I'll make it through and I'll come out on the other side. And I keep telling myself that, you know, I got sober for my son, but I am staying sober for me, because when I first started my sobriety journey, I didn't like myself enough to stop for me. I stopped for him, but I'm staying sober for me because I finally reached a place where I do have self-compassion and self-love, and it's taken a long time to get there.
Wow. And I mean, going back to something you said, like the reality is, I think, and maybe you've experienced this, you might, not you, but your healing might scare some people off. And probably, I'd imagine, has. Like, I've noticed this in my own life as well in different ways, and that's painful. Like, so yeah, you might scare people away. And it's like, it's for me, that is the most terrifying part of any kind of healing journey.
So I guess it's a good vetting process in a way.
Yeah, vetting process, exactly. But who or what has stayed with you as you've journeyed through this? Who has grounded you, or what has grounded you through these transitions in your life?
Ooh, well, definitely my son. Like, he was probably my biggest inspiration to heal and take better care of myself so that I could show up for him the way that he deserves, and the way, and in a way that I could be the best mom possible. And definitely my husband, Dustin, has been absolutely incredible. And it's, and I feel badly for him, because I know that he's, like, he's such a fix it person. Like, he, he if there's a problem, like, he wants to solve it, because that's just the kind of person he is. And I know it's been really hard for him to see me kind of struggling the way, that I have been through this healing journey and this sobriety journey. Because he always wants to help and wants to say the right thing and have a solution. And, but I remind him that it's okay, that just holding space for me is the most impactful thing that he can do for me. And he does that with such kindness and with such love. And, you know, we've been together so long that he's seen the best of me and the worst of me, the very, very worst. And he has still always chosen to see the light in me, even when I can't see it in myself. And having that kind of person in your corner it's life changing. And I don't know, I don't know if I could have had the courage to start this healing journey if it wasn't for his support as well.
Wow. I'm so glad that you have him in your life. I'm so glad that you have your son. And I'd imagine the practices that you have developed through, you know, we didn't even talk about your yoga business yet, but like through Shiny Rock Yoga, plug people. This woman has started her own yoga business. It's incredible. But she also works with high school students who need that mental health support, who need that support to express their own versions of self-compassion. Yeah. So I guess I'm curious about how practices like yoga or teaching, maybe you have others in mind, how have those become an expression of self-compassion for yourself?
Oh man, I've been practicing yoga for probably 16 years or so. And I remember when I first got into yoga, it was totally because I wanted to, I wanted to get in better shape and, be one of those like skinny, beautiful yoga girls with like the messy top bun and just like always look so happy and wonderful and skin glowing and all that stuff. And, but I noticed that the more I started actually just bringing my focus and awareness to myself and my own practice and really connecting my breath to my movement, it really started to deepen the sensation of the practice for me in ways that I wasn't expecting it to. Whenever I step onto my mat, it helps me give myself permission to exist and just be present. It's never pressuring, it's never daunting or intimidating, because it's a practice where I'm listening to my body constantly and doing it the way that I need to or not at all. It's, you know, choosing rest when I need it or asana when I crave movement. The more I embody myself, the more I do it for sure. Wow. I used to think of this like ideal version of myself that I wanted to be. And when I step onto my mat like that, those expectations are just gone, because I'm here for me and showing up for myself and all that I am when I'm doing my practice. And once I truly learned to love myself and I acknowledged that even in my worst moments, I still have always been worthy of self-compassion and I've always been enough. My practice became almost transcendent, because now I have such a strong desire to share my passion of yoga with other people, which is what inspired the creation of Shiny Rock Yoga, especially because my goal for it was for it to be a mobile company. So like I have all the equipment, like enough for up to 15 people, so that people who want to access it don't have to worry about having their own mat or any of the other stuff that goes with it. And really wanted to focus on bringing yoga to people who wouldn't necessarily be able to afford it. I always tell people that I'm open to conversation when it comes to like pricing and things like that, because I want it to be as accessible as possible. So it's definitely not a yoga company that I created for the purpose of turning a profit. More just building community and sharing what has been one of the most integral parts of my healing and self-compassion journey with other people.
Oof, love that. Well, and it goes back to me to the pillar of common humanity within self-compassion, right? You're recognizing this unique struggle that's not so unique. We all share it. This need to learn tools to process our own journey through self-compassion, and yoga, connection of breath with movement, is a beautiful way of not only connecting with ourselves, but with the community around us. And it sounds like you're offering that to people.
Yeah.
That's gorgeous. Yeah. I love that. So can you tell me about any kind of regular practice that maybe you implement for yourself? You mentioned yoga. Is there a mantra or a style or anything specifically that you practice maybe daily to continue learning and growing in self-compassion?
I have two things that I've been working on that I do utilize every single day. And one of them I call flipping the narrative, and the other one is living in the gray area. So flipping the narrative is just kind of, and that's pretty common in therapy as well, especially like things like CBT, but just talking about like when you have that negative thought, like how can you flip the narrative? Like not so it's a positive thought necessarily, but just like how can you flip the narrative to make it more compassionate and more accessible? So for example, you know, I might have a thought like, wow, I haven't had a lot of attendees to my yoga classes lately. Like people really must hate my style of teaching. That super sucks.
It's always where we go first.
But then flipping that narrative and saying like, wow, like it sucks that my attendance has been low for my classes, but I'm also pretty new to the studio and it might take time to build a following. So, you know, kind of being more cognizant of like, okay, this is where your anxiety brain is coming from. This is where your, you know, self-conspiracy theorist is coming in. But like, what is more likely and how can you shape it in a way that is coming from a place of more self-compassion? And I noticed that, and it was so cool because it was probably last year sometimes. I've been practicing this method for a while, but I actually was able to like witness the positive benefit of it in real time, which was so crazy because I was shopping for a formal outfit for one of Dustin's like work events. And I was walking around the store and kind of thought to myself, like, man, like I really suck at shopping for like fancy stuff. And then almost immediately, like as soon as that thought came out, there was this like louder thought that was just like, no, like you're just not seeing anything you like and that's okay.
Yeah.
But just like out of nowhere, like didn't have to do any convincing, nothing, like just wow. Reactive response. And it was so cool. Like I remember actually like stopping in the store and being like, what? Wow. And then I'm pretty sure a couple of like, people that were shopping like looked at me weird because I definitely said that out loud.
Wow.
Right? Yeah. Wow. But it was just, I thought it was so cool. And I was like, okay, like maybe this is helping. Like maybe this is actually making a difference. So flipping the narrative has been really powerful. And then living in the gray area. So like when it comes to self-compassion or having empathy for our own situations, sometimes we feel like we tend to see things in like black and white, or the people pleasing side of us likes to over justify or over explain, you know, the other perspective, or like justify someone else's negative or bad behavior towards us. And then it kind of invalidates our experience. So I've been finding like living in the gray area is kind of, you know, like, so an example could be, I could be thinking about how badly I was treated by a family member and how I'm hurt by this. But then, you know, I start to feel a little bit guilty because I'm like, yeah, but this family member has this and this and this going on and they're going through a really tough time. It's not fair to, you know, like feel shitty about this. Like they're having a tough time. And it's like, well, no. Both of those can be true at once. It doesn't have to be black. It can be, okay, like they are going through a tough time, but it still really sucks how I'm being treated.
Absolutely.
Like both of those can be valid and both of those can be fair. So it's like, I can, you know, I have to remind myself that this family member might have, hard stuff going on. And I feel like it's taken a lot because I feel like sometimes we're stuck in our reptile brain, like in our trauma response brain. And, but living in the gray area is starting to kind of come out of the reptile brain and maybe going upstairs a little bit more and being like, oh, like, okay, like that does suck for that person. But like my feelings about the situation are also valid.
Yes. Yes. So, and I still deserve to have them be recognized. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like when people get into their, I don't even know, like their trauma competitions and people say like, you know, like, I have this going on and I'm really sad about it, but like, oh man, this person had this like horrible, awful thing.
Oh yeah. The trauma, literally.
Stuff. And then I'm like, you can't, like your stuff is valid too.
Yes.
Like both of them can be valid. It doesn't have to be black or white. It's not one or the other. It's like, okay, that person had a really crappy, horrible thing happen to them too. But that doesn't mean that your feelings about this horrible thing that happened to you are any less real or any less painful.
Yes. Yeah. But we like to think in levels. It makes us feel better selves, I think, a lot of the time, right? So challenging that. And what I'm hearing from you in that, and earlier you mentioned something too that reminded me of the need for accountability when it comes to self-compassion, right? Both accountability to ourselves and the need to positive self-talk and reframe the situation like you're discussing here. Also, accountability to change the narrative with steps as well. You mentioned, you know, in a class, if people don't show up, you might first go to "I suck" or those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. You could say, "Oh, well, but I don't really suck. You know, people might come, or there might be this and that and the other thing that are going on." But unless you take steps and actions to try to better yourself and the situation, you're not really expressing self-compassion towards yourself or anybody else. Mm-hmm. So there is a level of accountability I think we have to have that you've touched on, where we're caring for ourselves by taking positive steps towards something else. We don't just sit back and go like, "Okay, well, I love myself." Okay, but how? Yeah. Right? How are you showing yourself that love? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Totally. And the accountability piece, I think, is huge, because, you know, people talk about that, you know, in intention versus action, or like the mm-hmm. response or the reaction. And I do believe that if intention is coming from a good place, as long as you're holding yourself accountable, like even if your intention was coming from a good place, but it still caused harm, it is still your responsibility to hold yourself accountable for your piece in that harm, like to a degree, like not take on the responsibility or the emotions or the actions of other people in response to that. Like that's their stuff. That's not yours. But, I do think it is, you know, when people say like, "Oh, well, like that wasn't my intention." So, and then, you know, treat that as a way of kind of, you know, not having to hold themselves accountable for any of that outcome. And it's like, well, no, like accountability helps us grow and it helps us learn. And it does help us become, I think, more compassionate for ourselves and for other people.
Totally. Yeah.
So I think accountability is really crucial when it comes to self-compassion. Absolutely.
Yeah. I love that. So I guess I'm curious, my dog is snoring. So if anyone can hear a noise, it's just Chloe snoring in the background. She's expressing self-compassion for herself through sleep. So, right? Such a cutie. So for those who maybe are listening and struggling to choose self-compassion, you know, I think both you and I can relate to the struggle it is to not be self-harmful in our criticisms of ourselves, right? Or like our judgments of ourselves. For those who are kind of stuck in that judgment space, struggling with the compassion side, what encouragement might you offer them?
For some of us, it can take an incredibly long time to even find the ability to have self-compassion and self-love. Like I said, like when I first started my sobriety journey, like I didn't even like myself enough for me to do it for me. Like I was doing it for my child. And I think in past attempts, I feel like that's almost why it didn't work in the past, was because I didn't care about myself enough to make that healthy decision for myself. So like it can take a long time to find that. But I think one of the most important things is making time for yourself outside of your identity as a parent or a partner or an employee or like any role that is in service to someone or something else. Like being able to find something that feeds your soul, that's, you know, where you create or move intentionally or just simply exist in moments that are just for you. Because I think that's really part of the space that you need to be in to even start exploring that self-healing journey. And like I said, sometimes we need a catalyst to get there. And like my son was definitely mine. And it was really important for that to happen at the beginning of my healing journey. And then I slowly started to realize that I did need to find space and time where it was just for me. And I think that's one of the reasons that yoga was such a powerful tool for me. But also finding things that you do just for you. Like they're not dependent on you benefiting other people or looking after other people or doing something for other people. Like it's just for you. And giving yourself permission to do that is probably one of the hardest things.
Because
we're socially constructed in this society to feel like our worth is dependent on our productivity and
absolutely.
You know, what we give back, and breaking that mold is hard. And like we already talked about, like, especially for neurodivergent folks trying to live in a neurotypical world, it can be exhausting, but finding ways to replenish and recalibrate are crucial. So like flipping your own narrative and beginning your own healing journey. And that's usually the hardest place to start. So, you know, putting down the bottle or the smoke or the technology, like whatever coping mechanisms that you're using. Like, I know how much that can suck and how hard that can be. And, but when you're using those coping mechanisms and you're using them to numb yourself, you're numbing yourself to the possibility of healing. Wow. It hurts and it sucks, but healing is really the only sustainable way to move forward in the self-compassionate way that everybody deserves.
Oof. That was good.
Yeah. It's heavy stuff. It's heavy good stuff.
It's heavy good stuff. It is. And I think that recalibration piece is key. And I think many of us have come from environments and society still tells us somewhat that it's selfish to pull back and to reflect. And that if you're, like you say, if you're not busy, you're not being enough of a contribution to the world. But I think the real nature of this work is this isn't just about yourself. If you're not showing up as who you are, the people around you are also going to suffer because they don't know who that person is, right? So it's about you, but it's also about the community you're in. And this work helps heal everyone, not just you.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. And so like, we should all do it. Right. But it is, it's hard and it does suck and it means a lot of shift.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm curious about, you know, you've come to this podcast, you know, that it's called Move With Your Life. What does it mean to you to move with your life?
I think stop fighting against the current. Like stop believing that, you know, that you'll be enough or worthy of good things when you like hit a certain point. Like once you do this or accomplish this, like then you will be, you know, this picturesque version of yourself that like deserves those good things. You know, just we're constantly changing and growing as human beings and we're constantly evolving into what I like to hope better versions of ourselves. And moving with your life is kind of allowing the waves to wash over you and continue to do the best that you can. Some days your best is going to look like accomplishing all the tasks, getting that workout in, drinking enough water, eating all the good food, being a super parent and a super partner. And then other days your best is going to look like lying in bed all day and recharging or, you know, feeding the family fast food or simply just existing because that's all you can do to keep your head above the water. And, you know, again, embracing that gray area that both are completely valid in those moments that you need them. Move with your life, accepting your feelings as they are, the good and the uncomfortable, and making space for both because we are just as valid when things are hard as we are when we're doing really well.
Well, I do want to say to you, Leslie, one of the most inspiring people that I've talked with about moving through. Oh, shucks. And I, you know, I say that, obviously that's a little bit of a flattery thing to say as well, but I also mean it. You've moved through some very challenging storylines and attachments and coping mechanisms, and you've brought yourself to a place of being able to take a hard look at what has caused that and change the script. And I think that is the bravest, most challenging thing that any human can do. So I'm so grateful for you sharing your story with us. And I've learned a lot in working with you, even having you as a client. I've learned a lot from sitting across from you and hearing your stories and your journey. So really appreciative that you chose to come on here. And I also want to say, you know, there's part of that too, that when we say how inspiring someone is, I think there can be a little bit of a dark side to that where it can feel like you have this responsibility to carry some of the weight of, you know, being inspiring to others. And I also recognize in you this authenticity to be okay falling apart when you need to. And so that both side of things that you were talking about. And I just hope you know how special you are and the work that you do matters. And I'm really grateful for it. So thanks for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And and I just want to say that, you know, the work that you and I did together had a long lasting impact on my healing journey. Like, I'll still never forget. I think it was one of our meetings, and you know, we started the conversation, and I think you had asked like how my circuit had gone that week or how my workouts had gone that week. And I was like, oh man, it's like, you know what? Like I didn't do them. And I felt so guilty about it. And it was so funny because like you picked up on it right away. And like instantly you were just like, well, let's unpack that. Why do you feel guilty about that? And it just like unraveled this whole like amazing mess in my head of, yeah, like, why do I feel guilty about that? Like, you just simply by asking that question, you kind of started me off on like another tangent of my self-healing journey of being like, yeah, like why do we find shame when we need to rest? Or like, why do we mm-hmm. feel the need to make excuses if we don't follow through with like some kind of workout? Like, mm-hmm. you know, cause some, you know, trainers and stuff would kind of respond and like, oh, you know, like you gotta keep up with it. Like you gotta keep going. And instead you're just kind of like, oh, like that's okay. That like, it is okay. Like, why don't you think it's okay? It's like, what? I wasn't prepared for that. Like that kind of, an invitation to reflection. And the work that you do is also truly incredible and has been like a huge part of, like, I would say it was also part of the catalyst for my healing journey as well. And I also haven't done any of those workouts in months, FYI.
Well, I might have to come at you as the hard ass trainer soon, but there's a place for both.
Yeah. Gray area.
Gray area. It's a gray area. Both ends.
I just wanted to say thank you as well, because it's just, yeah, like sitting on the sidelines and seeing all these beautiful, amazing things that you're doing and the way that you're supporting people and sharing your passion and your gifts, which there are many, by the way.
Thank you.
It's so cool to see all the wonderful things that you're doing, and people are very lucky to cross paths with you.
Wow. Well, thank you. Very humbled by that. Also very grateful for you and appreciative. Yeah. And thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
I'm saying this to every guest, so I have to have part twos with everybody, but like I want to have you back on the show. I do. So we'll have a follow-up one of these days. Be great to have you. All right. Thanks, Leslie.